Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org and podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Today we're broadcasting part of an event with Barton Gellman, which took place at the Armory for the Arts in Santa Fe on September 22, 2008. Barton Gellman is Special Projects Reporter for the Washington Post. He covers diplomacy, the Middle East, the Pentagon, the D.C. Superior Court, and he won a Pulitzer Prize along with partner Joe Becker for the series on Dick Cheney. This was his second Pulitzer Prize, and the Cheney series was expanded into Barton Gellman's book, Angler, the Cheney Vice Presidency. We don't have time today to broadcast the entire program, so right now you'll hear mainly the question and answer section. If you'd like to hear the entire speech, please go to my website, santafe.radiocafe.org, and you can find a podcast there of the whole event, which you can download or listen to at your computer. Here now, Barton Gellman.
Someone out in the lobby asked me why Angler, why that title? It's Dick Cheney's Secret Service code name. And the Secret Service has a sense of humor about these things. A lot of the times they assign a code name that has a sort of double meaning to it, or could be read that way. Cheney, of course, loves to fish, but he also gave me with this code name a nice metaphor for the way that he's operated in Washington. Mary Charlotte mentioned that this thing began as a series in the Washington Post a year and a half ago almost. I figured, well, that's 20,000 words. How hard can it be to turn it into a book? The thing is, I could not let go of the story. I'm not ashamed to say I became sort of obsessed that Cheney as my white whale. So I kept on reporting and reporting, and my publisher became more and more inclined to remind me about the deadline thing. I blew the date by almost 3 months. But I hope that'll be good news for you. Three-quarters of the book is new material, things that I did not know or did not have room to write in the paper or that hadn't happened yet. The last scene in the book, which is one of my favorites, took place just 10 weeks ago on the 4th of July. I'll just say this for the record. Don't try that at home. Publishers, it turns out, do not like to get the last chapter of a September book in July. Dick Cheney has been the most powerful and secretive person to hold that office, the nearest thing to a deputy president this country ever had. Angler does have a frame of reference. It has a point of view and a kind of authorial voice that I can't use in a daily paper, but it's not really a political book. It does not have a lot of adjectives. It's not a case for the prosecution or the defense. I'm a storyteller, and Angler's a narrative. The stories, nearly all of them, are new. I just skipped the stuff, mostly, that was well-known, used a little bit of it as context. My intent is to tell you what really happened, which of the myths about Cheney are true, which of them aren't true, and which things you've never dreamed of before. More than tell, I try to show you.
And from here, we go straight to the question and answers. I think this whole narrative that you were describing, in which the top people in the Justice Department nearly resigned, up to Ashcroft, basically, who said, as you describe in your book, from his hospital bed, having had gallbladder surgery, if I had known what was involved with this warrantless surveillance program, I would have never authorized it in the first place. What happened? I mean, this could have been the hugest meltdown in the last 8 years, and it didn't happen.
We knew about the Ashcroft hospital visit. That was became public in a riveting way in Jim Comey's testimony in the summer of 2007. We didn't know the context, and we didn't know all of it. What Comey testified, and later Jack Goldsmith as well, was that when Gonzalez tried to get Ashcroft to sign, Ashcroft said, first of all, that he was backing his deputy, and second of all, he said, I'm not the attorney general. I'm in the hospital. He is. He's the acting. He said more than that. He said, as you just described, he said he never should have authorized this in the first place. And Comey and Goldsmith and others were so outraged by this attempt to bring it to a sick man in bed that they were ready to resign at once. They went back to the Justice Department. There's this huge streaming in of senior officials from the suburbs, and they have a very late night meeting. And they start to hear word at that time that Bob Mueller at the FBI is also going to resign, which is an amazing thing. Now, just think about it this way. It ended up being about 24 people who were ready to walk if Bush actually authorized this over their objections.
Which he was legally entitled to do.
Which they're all good believers in the unitary executive. These are Bush appointees, and they are very conservative lawyers. And by the way, unitary executive is not in itself a radical theory. The first word of Article 2 of the Constitution is the executive power shall be vested in the president. And so the idea is that every member of the executive branch derives power from the president. That by itself is not radical. What Bush did at Cheney and Addington's behest was radical, which was to say that notwithstanding any objections from justice and notwithstanding any effort by the judicial or legislative branch that purports to limit my authority as commander in chief, I am ruling this program lawful. So there's 24 people ready to walk, and two senior political advisors to Bush compared this to Watergate, or specifically to the Saturday Night Massacre. Saturday Night Massacre involved three people, the two top people at Justice and the special prosecutor. This was going to be a couple of dozen, so massacre wouldn't be the word for it. I think it would be more like suicide for Bush. Dan Bartlett said that he never would have been reelected.
So what actually happened instead?
What happened was that, as I described in one of those scenes, I'll back up one day. Wednesday night's the hospital visit. Thursday lunchtime, Bush signs the reauthorization despite justice. I don't know how much he knew about what he was signing. Now, I should tell you that this is a rare example in my book. I think that Bush usually knew what Cheney was doing and usually was fine with it. Cheney had power because he was an implementer, and you get a lot of power from making decisions on details. But in this case, he really didn't know. He did not know until Wednesday that the authority was going to expire Thursday, and this had been a fight going on for 3 months. And then when he signed on Thursday, he did not know that big chunks of his executive branch were sort of about to stage a mass exodus. And so Friday morning, which is when Mueller and Comey think they're beginning their last day of work in government, they come to the normal 8:30 briefing to brief the president on terrorism. And Bush by now has heard from Rice that there's some kind of ferment at Justice. And so he calls Comey into his private dining room after the large group meeting. And that's when the conversation I described before takes place, and Bush finds out that that this has been going on for a long time and that there are going to be big resignations, and he calls Mueller in, and when Mueller confirms Comey's account, Bush caves in. He does a complete about-face. He, the decider, reversed himself. And I have to say, this is a historic moment for the presidency. There is not one other case in which a modern president, and maybe any president, has made a sort of a firm, absolute decision on one day, invoking his commander-in-chief powers on something that he considered a matter of highest priority, and the next day, when his subordinates force him to change his mind. This is something we didn't know, and that will end up being significant well beyond the presidency of George Bush.
I mean, it acted as a real check on executive power, but nobody knew about it. I didn't know about it. Nobody knew about it till we read your book.
It was suspected that there were going to be resignations.
Did it come out in the press?
What came out in the press was the hospital visit, And Comey testified that he'd had this private meeting with the president. He refused to say anything about it. And some people here may wonder how it is I purport to know the things that I'm writing in this book. And I have 70 pages of endnotes in the back that are very detailed on sourcing. You will see in the book that Comey granted me extensive interviews. I have and reproduce a copy of his resignation letter. I have emails. I have the email that he sent as he left the president's private dining room, and he said, told the president he was being misled in that email. And throughout the book, I try as much as I can to be transparent on sourcing. There are times when I can't be. There are some stories you just can't tell without confidential sources, but I worked very hard to get people to talk on the record, and I have on the record interviews with, you know, Andy Carr, Dan Bartlett, Condi Rice, Steve Hadley, Josh Bolton, Jack Goldsmith, I mean, down the line. Ashcroft, a little one, Rove, a little one.
So what were the consequences of this particular crisis on the actual implementation of surveillance, warrantless surveillance on Americans? I mean, can we sleep happily at night knowing that the law is being followed?
Well, you can know that the law, as Jack Goldsmith and Jim Comey saw it, is being followed. There is still a substantial program of warrantless domestic surveillance. They did not think all of it was illegal. They thought some things were illegal. And I worked really hard for several months to try to figure out what that was, and I just broke my sword on it. It's just too hard to get. What exactly is the program doing? What was it forced to stop doing? Exactly what the legal arguments were. I didn't want to weigh down the narrative with a ton of legal stuff, but I did research it very carefully, and for those of you who want it, there's one really long paragraph on the legal stuff in the main text, and then pages of endnotes that describe it in more detail.
What do you think the word and the concept democracy mean to Dick Cheney?
Okay, I believe that Cheney is a very principled man. He is a zealot. You have bigger impact on history by zealots than you do on hypocrites, because they just keep on driving. And he is not he's not his cartoon. For example, behind closed doors, he's a perfectly nice guy. If you get in his way, he'll run over you, but it's nothing personal. Whereas George Bush is quite mean and nasty in private, quite often.
As you say in the book, he's smarter and meaner than people think.
Right. Cheney's nicer than people think. He is committed to his principles. He's fairly upfront about what they were. He does believe in democracy. He simply has a very narrow concept of representation in a democracy. Without getting too far into it, I mean, he says that you should elect a president and then entrust him to govern. And that trustee model was more or less the formulation of Edmund Burke in 18th century England, and that's the model that the founding fathers left behind when they crossed the Atlantic. It's a very narrow version of what the public gets to do to influence its government. And Cheney is, frankly, pretty contemptuous of public opinion as being sort of feckless and emotional and illogical and changeable and sort of missing the main point and not knowing the main facts. He believes he knows what the country needs, and he believes that he should be judged by history. And when he says the word polls, meaning opinion polls, he makes it sound like something dirty.
It seems like he's contemptuous not only of public opinion, but of the entire legislative and judicial branches.
Look, he was the second-ranking Republican in the House. He is not contemptuous of the legislature. He believes, let's put it this way, he very often starts with a widely accepted proposition. Let's say in constitutional law that there are some powers that are exclusive to each branch. Most constitutional theorists would say that separation of powers isn't exactly the model here, that it's more like shared and overlapping powers. Cheney's sort of an extreme separationist, and within that, a presidentialist. And so his view is that the executive power is the president's, that in order to execute the law, the president has to interpret the law, and that's also self-evident and uncontroversial. And where he sort of jumps the shark is that his belief is that the other branches of government may not intrude in any way on the president's execution of the law, because that's his exclusive power. Just as he believes that the president can't make laws, the Congress gets to appropriate money and gets to say, you know, how many years federal felony gets for in jail and things like that. That judicial branch has its powers, but they can't touch him.
There's an interesting chapter in which you describe the appearance of Colonel Derek J. Harvey, who had been on the ground in Iraq, and he knew a great deal about what was really happening there, and he had a different view of the insurgency than the president did, and it seemed like than just about anybody in the White House did. And he went so far as to tell the president that the American troops in Baghdad were, quote, fighting the wrong war, unquote. Tell us more about this, because I thought that was very interesting, and how Bush and Cheney used that information.
I think it's pretty well established in the public record now that George Bush is not a guy who likes to be contradicted and doesn't like a lot of debate. He wants his advisors to work it out and bring it to him. And he was not at all happy to have this colonel, and he's used to talking to four-star generals, coming to the White House and contradicting everything he'd been told by his other advisors. And what Harvey said was, it's perfectly true that this is back in 05, I'm thinking. It's perfectly true that, here's what he said. He said there are only seven provinces, I think, that are a big security problem. And he said, referring to your neighboring state, that's a lot like saying that Arizona is secure except for Tucson and Phoenix. And he had a well-developed view about what you needed to do in order to win hearts and minds in Iraq, and it was very different from what they were doing. And Bush didn't want to hear it. He had one meeting with Harvey, and that was it. Cheney talked to him over and over again. Cheney delves into details. He, you know, the economists who brief him say that he will go just as far into the appendices as you want to go. He normally would ask for his visitors to come and give him a 10-minute uninterrupted briefing, you know, sort of initial presentation, and then they'd go into questions. And one of them, I think it was Martin Feldstein, told me that if he had gone and given a 10-minute opening statement to Bush, he'd never be back in the Oval Office again. So Cheney delved. He wanted to hear as many facts as he could. He wanted to hear more than Rumsfeld did about what was happening on the ground in Iraq. But he then came out in public and gave, you know, very sort of rosy scenarios, because he believed that, first of all, as we just said, he did not trust public opinion to make the right choice if given a sort of a subtle picture. And second of all, he believed that the national will was the most important resource for the war, that the only way the United States could lose would be by losing confidence of the public.
We talked when we spoke earlier and were on the radio together about how Cheney, and you mentioned this before, and his rules knew exactly what he wanted. And one of the main things that he wanted was to really concentrate the power of the executive. Was that, in your view, power for its own sake? Or what was his goal for the greater good of the people, if there was one?
I think there absolutely was one. Cheney is not a venal man. He was not seeking riches. He was not trying to help his friends at Halliburton. I found no evidence for that. He was, in fact, I found a substantial amount of evidence that he relinquished millions of dollars that he could have kept potentially under federal ethics rules, just to make sure that there would be no conflict of interest. And he's so secretive, he wouldn't even tell us that. He's not a venal man. He is serving the public in his own view of what the public needs. He wanted to concentrate power in the executive because he thinks it's a big, scary world out there, that there are terrible threats, that he understands them better than other people do, but in general, that The executive branch is the only branch capable of acting with a sort of secrecy and dispatch and unwavering commitment to a course. It's the only branch that can do that and protect the public. And he's always quoting Federalist Number 70, which talks about energy in the executive and secrecy and dispatch, all those words. He does not quote Federalist 69, which talks about the importance of Congress, and he's selective in the papers he likes.
So his view of the greater good was protecting the people of the United States?
Look, if you watch him on Meet the Press or listen to him on any of those conservative radio talk shows that I'm sure you're all listening to, he's pretty upfront about what he believes in, and he is not playing around. He is first and foremost worried about national security. He thinks that there is a terrible threat, especially the risk that terrorists will one day get their hands on weapons of mass destruction. He thinks that other people sort of can imagine that scenario. They'll read a novel about it, or they'll go to a meeting about it, but they can't keep the idea fixed in their head and remember how big a deal that would be. And that is the fundamental thing that he is trying to prevent, and that's why he thinks he needs to have so much power, or the president does, and by extension, Cheney, and why so much of what they do has to be secret.
It does seem ironic that, I mean, again, as we talked about this earlier, but when you have this goal of trying to protect people, trying to protect your own people, and then a million or more people in another country get killed and are themselves essentially victims of our terrorism. Does that not compute in the mind of Cheney?
I don't know. I don't know. There are places inside Cheney's head that I couldn't get. I know things about Cheney, and I'm very careful to say things about him only when I have a good report about what he said to Bush, because Bush comes out and talks to his aides about it, or when, you know, his senior foreign policy advisors finally agreed in many cases to talk to me on the record, David Wormser, Aaron Friedberg, Stephen Yates, some others who wouldn't talk on the record. So I have some picture of what he thought about that. If I had to guess, I would guess that he would say, life's tough. There's collateral damage. There are bigger things at stake here. I'm sure he wouldn't accept that there are a million Iraqis dead. I don't know that to be true myself, but certainly, you know, many tens of thousands, and certainly,
3 years ago, 600,000 was the number given by The Lancet, the British medical journal.
Yeah, it was a projection of excess deaths, and it was controversial. And I don't have the specialized knowledge to know which side of that controversy to come down on.
What kind of power did the president and vice president lose in the second term, and how did they lose it?
Well, they lost the confidence of the people pretty quickly after re-election. You have now, as everyone knows, the most unpopular president and by far the most unpopular vice president in the history of modern polling. Scott McClellan says that Katrina did them in, that was sort of the end of Bush's hopes for a successful second term. There's a interesting little vignette in the book about Cheney and Katrina, but I'll leave that for later. No, he didn't cause it. Cheney also lost power. That episode in March 2004 where he just about drove Bush off the cliff, and again, this is, I think, the biggest news in the book, because I'm able to tell that story hour by hour with lots of on-the-record, lots of documentary material. After that, Bush was a little more careful with Cheney, and he subjected Cheney's advice to additional filters, and he realized that someone who takes principle that far, and it was principled, Cheney said, we need this program. You know we need this program. You think we need this program. The Justice Department acknowledges that you are the chief law enforcement officer. If they resign, they resign. That's what leaders are for. You got to stand up and do what's right. Bush came to understand that Cheney could destroy him, that Cheney did not, would not consider political impact. And the vice president can be an anti-politician, but the president can't. And so there's sort of, I guess, there's a finish the thought. There's sort of a trajectory of the Cheney vice president in which he has enormous power and influence in the first term, and that's his sort of productive period where he actually in that the incident that starts with the funny phone call to the Interior Department, Cheney actually sort of changes the course of a river out west. He moves water rights from one place to another. He created the system of what he calls robust interrogations. He created the warrantless surveillance program. He was responsible for the bulk of the president's tax cut plans and even actually brought about a capital gains tax cut by working with his friends in Congress in ways that I'm pretty sure Bush didn't know about until very late in the game also. Later, Cheney's influence began to wane, partly because of the president and partly because of, I don't know, Newton's law. There was a reaction. There were people and institutions that rose up and tried to restore some balance to the system, and so he wasn't winning as many fights by having them when the other team wasn't on the field, and they were learning how to show up and they were learning how to fight. He's still a very powerful guy. He's still able to stop things from happening that he doesn't want, but he's having a harder time jamming things through.
David Addington also comes across as one of these people who, like Cheney, is extremely principled. Not principles that probably anyone in this audience would agree with, but nevertheless, and for example, the whole question of torture and brutal, cruel interrogations of various kinds in Guantanamo and the secret prisons and so on was a subject to which both of them devoted a great deal of energy. Both of them were very much in favor of the harshest interrogation techniques. And then I think it was in 2005, Congress actually passed a Treatment of Detainees Act, and Addington did an end run around it to weaken the act and was so harsh in doing so that he actually defeated himself. Tell us that story.
Well, there are two ways that Cheney and Addington responded to the Military Commissions Act and then the Detainee Treatment Act. One was, I mean, they didn't support either one. And in fact, for the Detainee Treatment Act, Cheney caused to be inserted in something called a OMB Statement of Administration Policy. And here you have to know that the Office of Management and Budget actually speaks for the federal government on every piece of legislation, not just budget stuff. And it issues formal statements. And Cheney's office inserted language, again, without many other people knowing it, that said that if Congress tried to regulate treatment of detainees, the president's senior advisors would recommend that he veto it. And then the Senate passed it 90-9, so there was no more talk of vetoes. And Cheney and Addington did two things next. One is that they worked with allies in the conference committee to insert some very technical-sounding language that had the effect of putting a lot more discretion back in the hands of the president, notwithstanding what the bill seemed to say. And the other is that Addington intercepted the signing statement that was going to be written. Now, Bush's political advisors and lots of his foreign policy advisors understood by then what a disaster the whole torture debate was, the whole Guantanamo debate, how much damage it was doing abroad and how much political damage it was doing to Bush. And they said, the bill's passed. Let's embrace it. Let's declare victory. And they wrote a statement in which the president welcomed the bill and so on. Addington intercepted the statement. It's a remarkable thing that a vice president's lawyer can do this. He has a red pen and he draws a line through the whole statement, several pages, and he substitutes one sentence which says that the president shall interpret this consistent with his powers as commander-in-chief and as chief law enforcement officer and blah, 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 blah. And it sounds like he's saying that Bush may be signing the law, but he doesn't necessarily feel bound by it. And, McCain and others who were sponsors of the bill went crazy because it was a huge slap in the face. And, in fact, Bush had to climb down from that and say, no, he really did support the bill, and it created a big political backlash, but it did not defeat the main objective of Cheney and Addington, because I'll give you it really in brief. The act said that the act banned cruelty, adopting the language of Geneva Conventions Article 3, Common Article 3, banned cruel, inhuman, and degrading interrogations. In the fine print, it said that this shall be interpreted under U.S. law in light of U.S. constitutional law, especially in the cases of cruel and unusual punishment, and that the interpreter will be the president. And Supreme Court law on cruel and unusual punishment has, without getting too far into it, has a balancing test. It depends on circumstances. What would shock the conscience, which is the test, depends on circumstances. And Channing Dannington immediately started saying that it wouldn't shock the conscience to waterboard someone if that could prevent a catastrophic terrorist attack.
Shock the conscience is such a subjective thing in a day when we're exposed to TV shows about torture.
Well, welcome to the U.S. Supreme Court. It's constantly trying to apply standards that are not at all self-applying. Sort of equal treatment under law, the right to confront witnesses, shock the conscience. They all turn out to be much more complicated in the hard cases. And it's true that the culture after 9/11 just took this turn toward, you watch the latest Batman movie or Jack Bauer on 24, and there's sort of torture in every scene, and it's almost taken for granted that under some circumstances, among viewers, you sort of look at Jack Bauer on the screen with the electric wires and you say, yeah. And a lot of people like that show and buy those values. Jane Mayer in The New Yorker wrote a very good piece in which she talked about 24 and how the fundamental scenario that happens, 7 times an episode is vanishingly rare if it ever exists in real life, which is the ticking time bomb.
Right.
The idea that that somebody right in front of you has the information and that there's an imminent catastrophic attack and you have to get that information right now. And I'll tell you, I think that if such a thing ever happened, I'd say that a lot of people of good conscience and a lot of presidents would say, this is in violation of the law. I don't claim this to be right under law, but if I know this guy can stop a nuclear explosion in New York, I'm going to do what it takes. It's a little bit like, on a more extreme basis, Lincoln suspending habeas corpus and then throwing himself on the mercy of Congress and saying, I know I couldn't do that, but kind of had to, and Congress went along. The thing is, ticking time bombs is almost never the actual scenario. When you've got a terrorist suspect and a threat, you have murky information that suggests that somebody might know somebody who might have been in a place, and sometimes they do and they have, and there's important information. But I've pushed hard on this, and I did the same in Israel because I was correspondent there, and this ticking time bomb was part of the Israeli jurisprudence for a while until it was overturned. I've never found a case where that scenario applied.
I think there's a fundamental difference between the conservative ideology that you're describing that requires torture and interrogation and requires invading countries like Iraq, who never did anything, and as you describe in the book, even Dick Armey, who was a 100% conservative Republican, knew very well that Iraq hadn't done anything and was against the invasion until Cheney kind of BS'd him in the scene that you described. That's all on the one side. On the other side is the democratic idea that you look at each country or each set of players and look at what their interests are and actually balance those out and try to see what everybody's interests are and negotiate in such a way that everybody's happy without having to use firepower except in the last resort. What is their critique of the latter kind of thinking?
Oh, that you're so naive. That the world is a scarier place than that, that human nature is darker than that, that carrots are fine but sticks work better, that the idea that you can negotiate something with Saddam Hussein or the clerical government in Iran or with the government of North Korea is just naive, that there's no agreement that you can make that would be acceptable to you that they will actually keep. And I have to tell you, there is strong evidence to suggest that that is true. Cheney believed that at least the threat of force is necessary in order to reach a diplomatic result. I actually think a deal could be cut with Iran. Personally, they're very big on marketplace and negotiations, and what they want most of all right now is recognition and the end of sanctions and the end of what they perceive to be a very serious threat to their security from the United States. They also would love to have hegemony in the Gulf and control over oil prices, and if they could get away with it, they'd like to have a nuclear weapon, I'm pretty sure, though they have not taken a decisive step yet to get that. But I think a deal could be cut with Iran. I doubt that a deal could be cut with Kim Jong-il. And I covered Iraq in the 90s and the weapons inspections, and Saddam turns out not to have had an active WMD program or big stockpiles, but you couldn't tell from what he was doing. He was lying constantly to inspectors and obstructing them, it turns out he wanted to actually look tougher than he was. But U.S. intelligence didn't know that. But there was good reason to think that he had some kind of chemical and biological programs at the time this last war started. I think the nuclear case was always crap.
How do you think history will judge Cheney?
One of the problems history is going to have is how to judge Cheney, because although he talks a lot about being judged by history, he hasn't been a great friend to historians. His secrecy and the way he's arranged things goes well beyond the here and now. A couple of examples, he had Addington was the guiding force in rewriting an executive order over presidential records, which makes it much easier for presidents and for the first time vice presidents to stop the release of documents that talk about national security, legal advice of the president, executive deliberations. In other words, many of the main things that historians would like to know about. They sort of made up a classification stamp in their office. It actually has no force of law or even executive order, but they made up stamps, and it says, treat as secret/SCI, meaning sensitive compartmented intelligence. And in the Libby trial, one document that was stamped that way was the press guidance. So it's obviously not a sensitive compartmented national intelligence secret. But when you stamp it like that, and it goes to the National Archives, and the archivist of 10 and 20 and 30 years from now has to decide which stuff goes in the release now pile and which stuff gets thrown into the, we have to review this carefully pile, you can guess where that's going to go. And so J. William Leonard, who was the head of security for the archives, said to me, he doesn't know what Cheney's intention was, he can't know that, but what the effect will be is that a lot of vice presidential records will be kept secret for a lot longer.
One thing I found somewhat encouraging reading the book was the amount of attention inside of the Justice Department to not so much following the president's policies, but to actually looking and judging them in terms of rule of law. Are these programs legal? People busting their heads for weeks and months to determine very, very difficult cases. For example, the example of what's the difference between an email and a phone call, and a lot of this electronic stuff, which is new and very tricky law.
Yeah, it's so tricky. I certainly busted my head on it. That long paragraph and pages of endnotes I referred to before, one of the things it says is that, and this is only, I know what the legal problems could have been, but I don't know what they were. One of the things they could have been, it's a small part of it, is that there is a four-part definition of electronic surveillance in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of the 1970s, and they treat different forms of communication differently. So if you acquire the signal en route, there's one standard. And if you take it from storage, it's another. So phone calls, they can easily get sort of mid-air or actually mid-fiber optic cable. But email, as some of you know, travels in packets. It's busted up into little pieces and flies around, takes 75 different routes to the destination, and then gets reassembled at the end. If you're intercepting email, you're taking it off the server, and that's storage. And so the standard is stricter, and the program might not have been distinguishing properly between them. Just one of lots of examples. Look, these guys at Justice and at lots of other agencies were working hard to do their jobs correctly, and that includes many of the political appointees. And, you know, make no mistake, Jack Goldsmith, who was head of the Office of Legal Counsel and is the first person to occupy that job ever to overturn opinions made by that office, including John Yoo's famous torture opinions. He's not a liberal. He's embarrassed by his lionization by the left. He thought that Yoo's torture opinions were outrageous, but he does not believe that as a matter of law, he's not talking about policy, as a matter of law, that the U.S. government is forbidden to use cruelty in interrogation. His analysis distinguishes the two.
Can you just tell people briefly what the Office of Legal Counsel is? Because it turns out to be very important and very unknown.
Yeah, it's this obscure office most of the time, but it became very big in the Bush administration. Office of Legal Counsel is run by an assistant attorney general. He's the fifth-ranking official in the department. And it's like the Supreme Court of the executive branch. When there are hard questions of law and, let's say, different agencies disagree, OLC renders an opinion, and that is binding on the whole executive branch unless it's overturned by the court. And most things never get to court, so it's a big job. And a huge part of Cheney's power in the first term was that David Addington, working with the deputy White House counsel, Tim Flanagan, had a kind of back-channel line into OLC, not the head of it. The head of it was kind of a figurehead, Jay Bybee. The person in the OLC they had this back-channel to was the famous John Yoo, who was just one of the line lawyers in the office, but he knew a lot about national security law. He had very well-developed views on executive power, which were, as an academic, when he published, they were kind of on the edge of respectable debate, and he was considered interesting and provocative and not crazy. But in the OLC, he just sort of blew past all the lines, and his opinions became binding on the executive branch. Plus, they were secret, so almost no one knew about them.
And secrecy is another theme. Was that one of your Cheney rules?
Well, the under-the-radar part is sort of like that. But, I mean, the secrecy was just pervasive. It was all-encompassing. Some of it was for legit national security reasons. Some of it, you could argue, was legit for because it represented legal advice to the president. But Cheney's overarching sort of views on secrecy are, I guess, twofold. One is strictly pragmatic. I mean, look, it just helps you get things done. Again, it's just a lot easier to make things happen if the opposition doesn't get time to mobilize. But he also believes, and this is a sort of a fundamental principle for him that I think just goes way too far. He takes, again, a perfectly respectable opinion, which is that in order to for the president to get good advice, there has to be some privacy of deliberation, because otherwise you're going to go into every meeting knowing that whatever you say will be on the front page of the Washington Post tomorrow, and so you posture and you don't give him really frank, candid advice. There's a point to that. Not that it stops me from trying to find out what they're saying, but there's a legitimate interest there. Cheney gives almost infinite value to that interest and doesn't consider other public interests. I mean, we do have an interest in good deliberations in the Oval Office, but we have other public interests, including holding people with power accountable for what they do with it. And you can't hold them accountable if you don't know.
I guess it's the opposite of what you would call transparency.
Yeah. Transparency is not big in the office of the vice president.
I have to say, I felt at moments like Jane Goodall, watching the people stomp around in this book, and especially Addington. But I wondered how you felt about Cheney, just as a human being, studying him for all these years and all this time of writing the book.
I think he's been tremendously destructive in many ways, and I document that. I have some things I admire about him. His work ethic. He has sacrificed for what he believes to be public service. He's absolutely sincere in believing that he has served the country. He's had 8 cardiac events in 8 years. He's given up, you know, probably close to $20 million in compensation he could have earned, and $4 or $5 million he already had earned and gave away so as not to create a conflict of interest. He looks like an old man. He looks frail now. I'll just give you one point of comparison. He was born, he's only 1 year older than Joe Biden. So, you know, compare and contrast. He is principled. Just at a personal level, he's a very likable guy. I knew him when he was defense secretary. Used to fly around with him because I covered Pentagon, the first Gulf War. And, you know, he would shoot the breeze with the reporters. He would go and have a beer sometimes when you had to. Those days, the engines weren't that efficient. They had to refuel at Shannon, Ireland, if they were going to go to the Mideast. And so we'd get off, and the bar in Shannon, as you imagine, has good stout. You'd come out and, you know, order a half pint and drink and chat. And I've got lots of stories, and most of them aren't in the book because they're not actually relevant to what he was doing as vice president, but lots of stories I've heard of his kindness or his consideration. He's not a guy who ever sort of tries to embarrass or humiliate people. He doesn't raise his voice. He leaves that to Addington. You know, he had a staffer who was pregnant, and Secret Service said, "You've got to walk down these stairs." And he said, "No, she doesn't. You know, let her get in the elevator. If he's going to be 15 minutes late and the driver's outside waiting, he'll walk outside and say, we're going to be another 15 minutes. I mean, Al Gore never did that by a long shot. And yet, the things that he pushed forward have been so harmful, even to his own objectives. If you look at what he came into office caring about, energy security, you know, we now have $100 a barrel oil. It was $144 in June. The Iraq war has been, I think, ratified by just about the whole sort of senior military leadership and intelligence leadership and, you know, most of the commentariat as a huge strategic disaster. And certainly what Dick Armey told me. He cared about executive authority, and he's managed to get it de facto, but by pushing arguments so far, he got 3 consecutive rebuffs from the Supreme Court. And the court actually, even though Congress was very compliant and gave Bush back whatever the court took away, the court has for the first time established that if the president wants to do something like a military commission, he needs Congress's permission. So, you know, Cheney goes and gets Congress's permission, you know, Bush does. But the precedent is there that the president does not have that inherent authority, and that's not a precedent Cheney would have wished to set.
Well, it's about time to go. I want to thank you so much for being here in Santa Fe, and I'm so glad that the state of investigative journalism is alive and well, at least in your hands and a few other great journalists. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.